Father, we just thank you for your constant care for us and your love for us. Thank you for this time to gather. Thank you for the opportunity to continue to look at your sovereign hand as it moves through time and recognize the issues that many of which we are combating in our day have roots in earlier centuries, and help us to understand how those things tie together. Help us to see things as you see them and to have your wisdom in discerning how to address the problems of our day and to understand what it is you would have us to do to please you. In Christ's name we pray, amen. So in our church history series, we are looking at movements in history. Sometimes they're movements within the church itself. Sometimes they're more historical movements that have an impact on society in general, including the church. And today would be a topic like that. We're going to be looking at communism. And to kick this off, we are going to look at two men, same city, different outcomes. Anybody recognize those two men? There you go. So we begin by looking and drawing a contrast between two famous men whose notable graves can both be seen today in the city of London. If you went to London, which I have never been there, I'm told you could go to visit the monument or grave that represents each of these two men are buried in two different places. Karl Marx lies in North London at Highgate Cemetery. So although he was Prussian, which Prussia was a major state within Germany at the time, you could think of him as German. Marx lived in London the last 34 years of his life. And there in London, he refined his radical secular ideology. He produced a book. In fact, there were a couple of works he produced. One of his more well-known works was Das Kapital, which is German for capital, setting loose upon the world ideas that have wrecked half of it and now threaten to wreck the other half. A good way to summarize Karl Marx, but we'll have more to say about him in a moment. Charles Spurgeon, on the other hand, his body lies in South London at West Norwood Cemetery, if you want to go there. Known as the Prince of Preachers, Spurgeon pastored what was allegedly the largest congregation in the world and often preached openly against many of Marx's ideas in his day. And it's stunning to contemplate the number of people that Spurgeon preached to in his day. He regularly had attendees of 10,000 people in his church, and this is before microphones, and he was able to be heard. There was an occasion, I'm told, where the Queen asked him to preach on the first day of creation, and he spoke to a crowd of 24,000 people in the Crystal Palace in London. So he's an amazing person. He was able to project his voice and hold the attention of so many. And such an outspoken preacher of his day, very sound theologically. We spent a whole lesson looking at Spurgeon, so we're not going to try to go back and redo that. But just in contrast to Marx, it's extraordinary to think that both Karl Marx and Charles Spurgeon lived and worked in the same city at the same time. I never really thought about that. But they did. They did. They were contemporaries. Both were, in a sense, even evangelists contending for the souls of men with their competing visions of humanity. Moreover, each was at the height of his powers at the same time as the other, so they were both sort of peaking right around the same time period. While Marx was preaching, quote-unquote, salvation through bloody revolution, Spurgeon, on the other side of the city, was preaching salvation through the blood and grace of Jesus Christ. Again, the contrast. And it's important to understand that the London of Marx and Spurgeon was the center of world governance and epoch-defining ideas. This was, in a very real sense, the center of the world ideologically. With Queen Victoria's missionaries to civilize it and her ministers, armies, and navies to rule it, the British Empire was at its zenith, so that the sun literally never set upon it. It's been said the sun never set upon the Union Jack during this period, such that they had so many properties that they controlled and around the world that it was always daylight on one of their lands. quite amazing. So whether it was David Livingstone searching for the source of the Nile, David was apparently from Great Britain, or Charles Darwin penning on Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection, Britain was at the forefront of all that was considered progress, not always necessarily good progress, as you can see. An air of revolution lingered over Britain of this era, like some ominous storm gathering on the horizon, threatening to engulf this peaceful kingdom as it had intermittently done on the continent since the French Revolution in 1789. So revolutions were afoot around the world. We've looked at the American quote-unquote revolution. We compared and contrasted it with the French Revolution, quite a very different revolution in terms of the nature and what it was based on. And there was threats of revolution occurring in other places. And at this time, there was a feeling or a threat that a revolution could very well take place within Great Britain itself. England was in the throes of the Industrial Revolution. This is a time period when things were transitioning from what it had been for centuries. Now we're now having, you know, mechanization and industry and machinery and things like this, and production is taking place at a rate that had never taken place before. And with that comes some downsides. The urban poor crowded the slums and populated the novels of Charles Dickens. You have heard of his writings. He's the one who wrote The Christmas Carol. I'm not a big fan of that story. Some people are, though. A lot of people are, apparently. Child labor laws were in their infancy. Black factory smoke choked the air, and coal dust filled lungs. So there was much work to be done in terms of dealing with some of the new things that were coming on the scene. It was into this combustible atmosphere that Karl Marx stepped, the man with a beard so wild that it might have landed him on a Kansas album cover, were he born a century later. And he had revolution on his mind when he moved from Paris to London in 1849. Of course, revolution was always on his mind. Marx had sought the overthrow of governments throughout Europe, and in the ensuing turmoil of 1848 was forced to flee the continent being the European continents, and he fled to this island of Great Britain to the north. Spurgeon combated Marx and his ideas, just as the Apostle John had once opposed Cerinthus. Augustine had used his formidable intellect to confront Pelagius, so here we have a facing off between Spurgeon and Marx historically. For example, in Spurgeon's sermon on Psalm 118 in June of 1878, Spurgeon made a tentative prediction to his congregation. He said, "German rationalism, which has ripened into socialism, may yet pollute the mass of mankind and lead them to overturn the foundations of society. I say not that it will be so, but I should not wonder if it came to pass, for deadly principles are abroad and certain ministers are spreading them." So Spurgeon was aware of the political environment of his time. He saw some of this German rationalism, of course, again, Marx is German himself, permeating the thinking of society. And he saw ministers who were preaching this stuff in his day, liberal ministers, of course. And Spurgeon was very alarmed by this and concerned of what it would do to society if it were to take root. And it's thought, very likely, that the preaching of Spurgeon and others like him actually prevented the violent revolution of Britain that Marx sought. I think Marx would have loved nothing more than for his revolution to have taken place in Great Britain. That's not how it played out, as we will see. So just to kind of give us an introduction here, I thought that contrast was rather interesting. So I want to now just take a brief look at the history of communism. And this is going to be a very 30,000-foot flyby because there's much to look at. Since its start a century ago, communism, a political and economic ideology, calls for a classless, government-controlled society in which everything is shared equally, presumably. And communism has seen a series of surges and declines over this period of time that it's been in existence. It actually started in terms of being implemented. I mean, Marx's ideas precede this, but it actually got its start in 1917 Russia, and it became a global revolution taking root in countries as far-flung as China and Korea, Kenya and Sudan, Cuba and Nicaragua, the other side of the world. Communism has spread, as we will see. Communism launched from Lenin's October Revolution and spread to China with Mao Zedong's rise to power, and to Cuba with Fidel Castro's takeover, just to name a few places where it has spread. It was the ideology behind one side of the Cold War and saw a symbolic decline with the fall of the Berlin Wall, Cold War being a war that went on for a number of decades between the United States and Soviet Union primarily. And it's called a Cold War because there weren't any actual shots fired, but there was definitely an undercurrent of war taking place as each side was trying to outmaneuver the other. And in the end, the Soviet Union is the one that lost with the fall of the Berlin Wall. Again, we will see a little bit more about this in a moment. Today, just a handful of countries remain under communist rule. Following is a timeline of notable events that shaped communism's arc in history. So now we're going to, let's just get the introduction here to the kind of the main bullet points or dates, if you will, that mark the spread of communism, the rise and fall, if you will. And it's not completely fallen by any means, but has certainly reached its peak and come down some. So we go back first to February 21st, 1848, when German economist and philosopher Karl Marx, who we've already looked at, and Friedrich Engels, his supporter and co-author, published something called the Communist Manifesto, another work that the two of them produced. And that work called for a working class revolt against capitalism. Its motto was, "Workers of the world unite." And this became the rallying cry, and you probably have heard this motto. It didn't actually get experiential traction until November 7th, 1917. So quite a few years there between the ideology being put into print and somebody actually trying it out. And that occurred in Russia with Vladimir Lenin at the helm. The Bolsheviks, who were Marxist, seized power during Russia's October Revolution and became the first communist government. Later that month, the leftist socialist revolutionaries defeated the Bolsheviks in an election, but despite his promises of bread, land, and peace, Lenin used military force to stay in power. And it was during this period that Red Terror, which involved the executions of the Tsar's officials, prisoner of war labor camps, and other police state tactics were established. So they managed to take over through military strength. There was an election, they lost, and they said, "Too bad, we're staying, and we're going to use our military strength to stay in power." On July 1st, 1921, inspired by the Russian Revolution, the Communist Party of China was formed. January 21st, 1924, Lenin died at the age of 54 of a stroke, and Joseph Stalin, who served as Lenin's general secretary, eventually took over official rule of the Soviet Union until his death in 1953. So he had a pretty good run of years there. He died eventually from brain hemorrhage in 1953, but he had, as you can see, about 25 years? He industrialized the country through a state-controlled economy, but it led to famine, which is something that communism typically leads to because it's based on fallacious thinking. Under his regime, detractors were deported or imprisoned in labor camps. And as a part of the Great Purge, catch this, 1 million people were executed under Stalin's orders. Brutal, brutal regime. But that's the only way communism can survive, is by sheer force. And so if we kind of look out over the landscape from going forward, just a big picture view to give you an idea of how far communism spread around the world. If you look at the years from 1949 to 1979, communism was established either by force or otherwise in the following countries: Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania, Yugoslavia, Poland, North Korea, Albania, Bulgaria, Romania, Czechoslovakia, East Germany, Hungary, China, Tibet, North Vietnam, Guinea, Cuba, Yemen, Kenya, Sudan, Congo, Burma, Angola, Benin, Cape Verde, Laos, Cambodia, Madagascar, Mozambique, South Vietnam, Somalia, Seychelles, Afghanistan, Grenada, Nicaragua, and others. That is a lot of countries. I read the list just to give you a feel of how many places communism was popping up. Now, a good number of, though not all, of those countries were actually came under the dominion of the Soviet Union or Russia, and they were either like some of the Warsaw Pact nations that you see over there on the east, with you got Germany split in two. This is after World War II. You got East Germany and West Germany. You got Poland, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, and Romania. You've got Ukraine, you've got Lithuania, and so on. You can see all the different countries that were involved in that. There were other countries that became communists along the way. Yugoslavia, for example, they never really became part of the Soviet Union, but they did become a communist country. They had a relationship with the Soviet Union for a while, but they also kept a relationship with the West. So just to look at how that unfolded a little bit more granularly here, we look at a significant date in May 9th of 1945. This is the end of World War II. The USSR declared victory over Nazi Germany in World War II. Well, actually, the Allies all declared victory. That included the United States and Britain, as well as the Soviet Union. But the Soviet Union was coming in from the east, and the United States and Great Britain, Europeans, were coming in from the west, moving into Germany and Berlin, and they were going to split things up because the Soviet Union had its eye on having control over everything they took over. And the West wasn't too happy about it, but they were allowing it to happen. What I understand, General Patton, whenever they got to that point, said, give me an army, let me keep marching. Let's go right on into the Soviet Union. Let's get this thing done. And, of course, there was no appetite for a continued war at that point. But I think Patton had something there. So the USSR declared victory. With Japan's defeat, Korea became divided into a communist north, which the Soviets occupied at the time, and the South Korea, which was occupied by the U.S. That later became a flashpoint for war, as we'll see. The following year, Great Britain Prime Minister Winston Churchill made his famous Iron Curtain speech in Missouri, alerting Americans to the division between the Soviet Union and the Western Allies. Because I can imagine this was probably somewhat confusing for some people, because Russia was an ally in World War II. And it was kind of a needed ally, because it was helpful to distract the Germans from the east, you know, on their east side, and us on the west side. By splitting Germany, it made it difficult for them to be able to pull off a victory that looked at one point quite certain. But in the providence of God, it was not so. So Russia was seen as sort of an ally, but not so much. And after the war, that became clear. And of course, once people became, you know, the people who were newly under communism realized what communism was, they wanted out. And so the communists do what they do. They kept people in. They put up a big wall and said, no, you can't get out. You're trapped. And so there's this, Churchill described it in his poetic way, as only Churchill could do. He was so eloquent. He said that an iron curtain has descended across Europe that's divided and is keeping in the people who want to get out. And it's making a very clear dividing line between free and not free, communists and the West. So a year later or so, March 12th, Harry Truman, who was president of the U.S. then, addressed Congress in what would become known as the Truman Doctrine, which called for the containment of communism, and later leading to U.S. entry into wars in Korea and Vietnam to provide defense from communist takeovers. The doctrine became the basis for America's Cold War policy. So there's that Cold War I was telling you about, like I said, primarily between U.S. and the USSR, Russia, Soviet Union, whatever. At this point, the Americans are beginning to see communism as a threat, and they're saying, you know, if this communism's spreading, if the whole world becomes communist, we don't want to become communists, but if eventually they take over the whole world, they could take over us too. Now we have a new threat. And so Truman wanted to establish a policy where we would try to keep communism from spreading long before it got to just us by helping other countries that were combating and trying to hold out on communism. October of 1949, following a civil war, China's communist leader Mao Zedong declared his creation of the People's Republic of China, leading the United States and diplomatic ties with the People's Republic of China for decades. In fact, it wasn't until Nixon that we reestablished diplomatic ties with China. July 1950, leading United Nations forces, the first U.S. troops engaged in the Korean War after communist North Korea invaded South Korea with the intent of creating a unified communist state. The war lasted until July 27, 1953, with North Korea and China and the United Nations signing an armistice agreement. And to this day, we still have troops in South Korea, and there's still a threat there from North Korea. That threat has never ended. We've never pulled it. What's that?
The war technically didn't end. It's a ceasefire.
That's true. It was just a ceasefire. The beginning of many wars were, it wasn't a clean ending like the two world wars that had. So we roll forward all the way to 1976, following the fall of Saigon. You've heard some references to that recently in relation to what was going on over in Afghanistan, how this was not going to be Saigon, you remember. And you might not have known what that was about. That was at the end of the Vietnam War. South Vietnam's capital was seized by communist forces. A few months later, in July, the nation was reunified as the Socialist Republic of Vietnam under communist rule. Very unfortunate, and I don't have time to go into all of it, but the United States fought in the Vietnam War. The whole time I was growing up, I thought I might have to be one to go over there and fight in it as I was coming of age, and the draft was still going on for a time and so forth. Many of us know people who fought in the Vietnam War, I'm sure. A long war, it became a very unpopular war. But what's so unfortunate about it is the United States actually won the war. Nixon actually established a peace agreement between North and South. We began pulling our troops out, and all we did was continue to support the South Vietnamese to keep the North from coming in and overrunning them, keep them from becoming communists, which the South did not want to become. But Nixon, because of Watergate, became very unpopular and ended up having to resign, and Congress was controlled then by the Democrats, because the Democrats started making sweeping advances politically because of Nixon's demise. And the Democrats wouldn't fund South Vietnam, and so it fell. All that time spent in war. We could have had it, we could have kept it, but they just let it fall. History repeats itself, doesn't it? It's sad, it's sad. October 1983, it was a little bright moment. United States invaded Grenada under the orders of President Ronald Reagan to secure the safety of American nationals under the country's communist regime, led by Prime Minister Maurice Bishop. The pro-Marxist government was overthrown in about a week. And if you want to see a good movie on that, Clint Eastwood made one called Heartbreak Ridge. I liked it at the time. But it's amazing to me, Clint Eastwood's still around kicking, making movies. The guy's in his 90s, and he's still directing films. But that's another story for another day. Anyhow. June 4th, 1989, a day I remember well, after weeks of protest, the communist Chinese government sent its military to fire on demonstrators calling for democracy in Beijing's Tiananmen Square. The bloody violence ended in hundreds of thousands of deaths, although there's no official death toll. I suspect it's much, much more than hundreds of thousands. But it was on TV for all to see. There were a number of people in China that were fed up with communism, and a bunch of students, young people, and others were in the streets marching against China, and China said, yeah, okay, fine, we'll just bring the tanks in and mow them. They mowed them all down. Mowed them down right in the street, right there on TV. Also in 1989, related to the Soviet Union, the Berlin Wall, remember Berlin's in Germany, when Germany was divided in half, and the wall is what divided the Soviet Union from the Western powers, and it kept everybody in. The Berlin Wall that separated communist East Berlin from democratic West Berlin for nearly 30 years fell. Fell meaning they no longer kept up their guard there, and people were allowed finally to come across the border. The years 1989 to 90 saw the collapse of communist regimes in Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Bulgaria, Poland, Romania, Benin, Mozambique, Nicaragua, and Yemen. So this is a crumbling of the Soviet Union. They could not maintain economically and politically. and it just began to crumble out from under them. December 25th, 1991, with the resignation of Mikhail Gorbachev, the Soviet Union was dissolved. New Russian President Boris Yeltsin banned the Communist Party. Communism soon ended in Afghanistan, Albania, Angola, Congo, Kenya, Yugoslavia, and other nations. However, China, Cuba, Laos, Vietnam remained under communist control. North Korea remained nominally communist, although the North Korean government does not call itself communist. It's just a thug dictatorship, but that's what communism is, so call it what you want. So that's kind of a very high-level, quick overview. I mean, a lot of stuff we could have really dived into there, but we just tried to give you a big picture of the spread of communism, its beginnings, and kind of where things stand today. So I want to ask kind of the philosophical question. Is communism a good idea? I'm sure you've picked up from the way I'm talking about this that it's not, in my opinion, but I want to walk through that a little bit. Ideas have consequences, sometimes good, sometimes bad. Sometimes catastrophic, like the ideas of Karl Marx. It was Marx's ideas that Lenin and Stalin built the Soviet Union. It was on his ideas that Mao built communist China, and innumerable other tyrants, from the Kims in North Korea to the Castros in Cuba, all of them built their communist regimes on Marx's ideas. It's amazing how much bad influence that one man has had. Ultimately, those regimes and movements calling themselves Marxists, catch this number, they've murdered about 100 million people and enslaved more than a billion. That is a huge number of people. But this is what communism does. It destroys, it kills, it murders, it enslaves. And in a big way. Marx believed that workers, specifically those who did manual labor, were exploited by capitalists, the people who owned, as Marx put it, the means of production, specifically factories, but who did very little physical labor themselves. So he was upset about the fact that people owned factories and could make people work, and they themselves didn't actually do any physical work. They were managing and owning their and profiting from their capital. And he just thought that was completely unfair and completely wrong, and this was not going to last. Only a workers' revolution, Marx wrote in Das Kapital, could correct this injustice. So a philosophy of government that started out about correcting injustice resulted in the deaths of hundreds of millions and enslavement of billions. What would that revolution look like? Marx and his collaborator, Friedrich Engels, spelled it out point by point. I mean, they were very clear about what they were going to do, and they spelled it out in the Communist Manifesto, was the work they co-authored together. It included the abolition of property, no more ownership, no more inheritance, so you couldn't give something to your kids, the centralization of credit, communication, transport in the hands of the state, and a whole lot more. In other words, the state owns and controls pretty much everything in communism. That's if we want to boil it down, that's what communism is. This notion of total state ownership was widely discussed and debated in European intellectual circles during Marx's lifetime, but nothing much came of it until Vladimir Lenin took over power in Russia in 1917. So it was a sort of a philosophical concept that people were kicking around, but at some point, as we saw, it actually went into practice under Lenin in Russia. And this changed everything. Despite its repeated economic failures, Lenin's Russia, which became known as the Soviet Union, became the model for dictators around the world. They salivated as they looked on and said, wow, what power. Hey, that's a good idea. I think we want that. Whenever Marx's ideas were practiced, life got worse, not by a little, but by a lot. There's not a single exception to this rule. Not the Soviet Union, not Eastern Europe, not China, not North Korea, not Vietnam, not Cuba, not Venezuela, not Bolivia, not Zimbabwe. Anywhere communism goes, there is misery, and tons of it. There's economic collapse, terror, and famine always follow in communism. It's just it's a flawed system. It's based on flawed premises. So if cataclysmic failure, meaning terrible human suffering, is the inevitable legacy of Marxism, and I don't see how anybody could argue that it's not, why do so many people, and now especially young people today in our country, I'm sure you're aware, think communism's a great thing? You know, 20 or 30 years ago, you could politically destroy somebody if you could convince the public they were a communist. That was it for them. They were over. No more. No more. Communism is now considered a good thing by a lot of younger people. And it's stunning to think about that. So why is that? Well, the most common answer Marxism advocates offer is that they, whoever they are, Lenin, Stalin, Chavez, whoever, they didn't really practice Marxism. They somehow got it wrong. So that real pure communism is really a good thing. And the guys who did it out there, that they just they did it wrong. Marxism, we're told, at its essence, is about sharing what we have from each according to his ability to each according to his need. That's supposedly the motto of communism, as Marx put it. And maybe that sounds good to you. But what does it mean? Who determines ability? Who determines need? You want to guess? The state under communism determines all those things. The ruling elite. Under Marxism, that's who has all the power. It's the state. And they determine what your ability is. They determine what your need is. That's why the truth is this. Marxist dictators like Lenin, Mao, and Pol Pot really did get Marxism right. They wanted absolute power, and Marxism gave them the way to get it. That's what it was all about. Karl Marx never had to face the consequences of his theories. He lived most of his adult life breathing the free air of London, England, living off the generosity of his collaborator and patron, Engels, who, as it happens, inherited his money from his wealthy merchant father, who got it from the capitalist system. Interesting. Marx spent his days in the reading room of the British Museum researching and writing, and although he was obsessed with the term scientific, he was never able to marshal data to prove his theories. There's a good reason for this. There is no data to prove his theories. For all of his time in the library, Marx couldn't find any evidence to suggest that capitalism, the free exchange of goods and services through privately owned businesses, was a passing phase. That was his argument. this is passing. This can't last. This is unjust. This is terrible. Throughout the industrial age, working conditions constantly improved and wealth expanded. Not to say there aren't bad things that happen under a capitalist system, that there aren't bad times, but compared to communism, there's no comparison. Marx had to rely on outdated reports to make his case, and even then, he had to manipulate the data to get it to conform to his theories. He wasn't really honest in his scholarship. Marx really had no interest in proving his theories. He knew they could be put into practice, but only by brute force. And he's very clear about this in his writings. He says, of course, in the beginning, communism cannot be effected except by means of despotic inroads. His ends could be attained only by forcible overthrow of all existing social conditions. He was very clear up front what his system involved. All social conditions. That's religion. That's family. That's personal possessions. Freedom. Democracy. They all have to go in order to achieve Marx's vision of an earthly paradise. Which it is not. But since few people give up liberties and property voluntarily, imagine that, creating a communist state has always required guns, prisons, and summary executions. Marx's many disciples from Lenin on never considered this a problem. Some, like revolutionary poster boy Che Guevara, he's a Cuban revolutionary, rather popular with some people, he considered it a bonus. He said, I don't need proof to execute a man. I only need proof that it's necessary to execute him. I don't need to make a case against somebody. If I think he's in my way, that's all I need to know. He's done. He's gone. I'll just execute him. If you're still a fan of Marxism after all the death, suffering, and destruction it's caused, that's your right. But own up to it. Don't hide behind it's never really been tried line. It has. It's been tried. And the results are obvious. Well, again, much we could say, but we'll have to draw to a close there. Next week, we look at another interesting topic. We're going to look at the Civil War in the United States, what I like to call the War of Northern Aggression. it's a very interesting war, and you may think you know the reason it was started and the reason it was fought. We'll talk about that. Churches on both sides of the divide there in terms of how that played out. A lot of good things to see. I will have a real challenge trying to summarize all that because I'm trying to do everything in 1 week because I just don't have that much time to cover all the many exciting topics there are to cover in history. So look forward to that. All right, discussion time about today's lesson. There are many today who say that a pastor should never talk about political ideas from the pulpit. Spurgeon, the prince of preachers, apparently had no qualms about doing so. What do you think? Is it ever appropriate for a pastor to mention, critique, or endorse political ideas from the pulpit? Why or why not? It's a big deal. I've been in a lot of churches where like, don't want to do that. Don't go there. I've tried to show that communism is a horrible form of government to be avoided at all costs. Do you agree or disagree? Why or why not? So I can't assume that everybody in the class just agrees with what I've come up with. I'm telling you why I think what I think, but feel free to have another view. And why do you think so many young people today view communism positively in spite of its abysmal track record? Now, I gave one suggestion, which is they think it's never really been tried, but are there other reasons? I suspect there are, actually. But be interesting to see what you all think. So there we go. Just three questions. But I figure they will entail a good bit of discussion if we want to dive into them a bit. So feel free to have at it. Or again, make up your own question. It's always free. Yeah.
I think young people today think of it as positive because the government is handing all freebies out to them. So it's like, of course, let's do what the government says because this is all free.
Yeah.
Just like the free education they want to give out right now.
Mm-hmm.
They're paying for people's debt that they had made the decision to go ahead and take out loans to be educated, but now our government is stepping in and saying, oh, we'll pay that off.
Yeah.
No problem. So how does that make other young people feel? They feel like, well, the government's going to take care of me if I follow what they're saying.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you're right. I think that is a factor for sure. I think for sure that is a factor.
One of the things, too, there's an age issue there. So there are a lot of young people who don't know what it was like when the Soviet Union was actually in power.
Yeah.
They don't have that memory. What's not ingrained into their childhood, having bomb drills at school was not something they grew up with.
Right.
So that's kind of never having lived under the threat of invasion, they believe they have nothing to fear. Certainly not a form of government. It can't really be that bad.
Right.
It's not talked about in the media like it was the horrible famines in North Korea where the government didn't have to kill them. They were dying of starvation.
Yeah.
They can't support their own population. That's what eventually led to the fall of the Soviet Union. They couldn't support themselves.
Yeah.
Even with killing off all the dissidents, which helps.
For a while.
Can't feed your own people. The remaining well-known communist countries, China, they don't understand that with the state-controlled media, it's going to be portrayed positive. They're not going to know what's actually happening there.
Yeah.
And there are no more, I guess with the Soviet Union, it was so large that it could be infiltrated. So people would get in there and send stories about this is what it's really like here. I don't think that really happens in China. I don't think we really get true accounts, not in the mainstream society, true accounts of what it's like for most people. You see happy, smiling people, and they like where they are, and the government is good, and everyone's well taken care of.
Huh. Yeah, and they also have a lot more means at their disposal in terms of technology. I've heard there are more cameras in China than there are people. And
there's more what?
Cameras. And you can actually, I've read articles where people actually got in trouble for having a unacceptable facial expression when something was going on positive related to communist leaders or whatever, and they were scowling or whatever. They could actually get in trouble for that. Just it's all on the cameras. The control exerted there is amazing. And then the economic tie-in in the United States to Chinese businesses and supply, and I mean, they supply a lot of our goods. And so a lot of industries are just completely sold out to China as a wonderful place, and nobody dare criticize them. And we've seen people punished for coming out, even making obvious statements about what's wrong with China and some of the things that they're doing with the Uyghurs and their concentration camps and things that we do, information does leak out about. immediately those people are punished for making that known or saying something about that.
You kind of see it happening. I mean, the change in the young people because of the training they're getting in colleges from socialists.
Yeah.
And it's just passing on. I mean, all they've known for 20 years is the war in Afghanistan. You know, they really don't know what war is.
Yeah.
And they don't know how to, you know, they're making capitalism evil and socialism good.
Yes.
And that's what's changing the young people's minds today, you know, in society. I mean, you can see what happened in January 6th, the people's reaction about January 6th.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, it's starting even earlier. When my kids are going through school, they stopped teaching civics. So it's not just that they're doing all of that, but it's also that they're coming from a place of complete ignorance,
right?
Because they're not being taught our history. They're not being taught any of it. In fact, I just saw an article the other day that stated, it was a child's workbook that stated that when the Europeans came to America, the indigenous people gladly moved to give them room. It was an actual child's workbook. Like the Trail of Tears was voluntary. That's basically what it was teaching. So you have a lot of that going on. And then they get to college, which is even more indoctrination. And like you said, all of the tech that, you know, we grew up, I remember the political cartoons that you had posted about the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
You know, the only way out and the guys at the firing squad, because that's how you get out of the USSR.
Right.
But like he said, my kids don't. You know, my kids don't know any of that from a personal point of view. They can maybe read about it, but it's not anywhere near the same, you know, as... And then, of course, Vietnam and Korea are still portrayed to our young people as we were terrible and we should have never been there.
Yeah.
And I've talked to my own kids about, you don't understand, there's a reason we weren't just over there because we wanted oil, which is what they all believe now. We were only there because we wanted their...
Vietnam?
Well, in general, we go over there because we want to take
jungles.
Their stuff. That's
yeah.
The premise.
Right, right.
We just go over there because we want their stuff.
Yeah.
I think the other bigger thing, everything is only looked at through an economic lens, not through a social lens.
Yes.
Yeah.
So nothing is talked about the control that government, a communist government, imposes on its people with regards to belief systems, behaviors, career paths. I mean, these, we know, people who are old enough know, they take you when you're a kid if you have something they want.
Yep.
If you're good at this, they take you from your parents and they put you in the school, and that's where you grow up.
Mm-hmm.
Religion, pretty much illegal. All of it.
Mm-hmm.
Not just Christianity, all of it.
All of it.
Yeah.
And so the government is your religion. Your leaders are your gods.
Your religion, your everything.
You know, and those kinds of things aren't talked about in Western culture. All they look at is the economic lens. What can make me money?
Mm-hmm.
Does it work? Will my family be provided for? Can I be provided for without having to work? That's great. Let's do that.
Yeah.
and already we are put ourselves on the path that caused those systems to fail. So it's almost like, to me, it looks almost like a bloodless coup where we are actually... We have already started down the socialist road because the government, with its handouts, has kind of already bought the people. But we know, just from looking, that cannot be sustained. That's fake money. It's not real. And eventually, when someone calls your card, you collapse.
Mm-hmm.
It's happened all around the world, to big countries, small countries. It's just almost like a willing ignorance or blindness, you know. But I think if not having had to see what happens when the government is in charge of the social structure of society, I think that's when people will really start to understand. But usually by that time, it's too late.
Yeah, our kids here are all like, they don't understand. They don't have a clue the kind of freedoms that they have here,
right,
to rail against the freedom. You know, this is like...
It was a scary interview I saw with a former KGB guy, I think it was, who said that years ago the communists had this as an objective to brainwash the younger generation. If they could get a whole generation
right,
brainwashed, he said, you know, once they've been effectively brainwashed, he said, you will never convince them otherwise, no matter what you say to them. And they won't realize it until the communists come in and they're thrown in the prison camp and the gate slammed. He said, it's only at that point that they'll suddenly wake up and realize, oops. And he said, then it's too late.
So you can actually see from the models that we come up with, I mean, as far as, like you were saying, everything's built on money, build back better. Make
yeah.
America great again.
Yeah.
Which is talking about freedom and liberty.
Yeah.
This motto is talking about freedom and liberty. There's nothing in build back better about that.
Yeah.
Every couple of years, I'll get out my copy of Animal Farm.
Oh, yeah.
Gosh,
and read
yes.
it to my kids. And what you were just talking about, indoctrination, the pups are born and
yeah.
Napoleon takes the, and then they grow up to be these guard dogs. The constant moving of the goalposts, so what begins as everything fair and equal. All animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others.
Four legs good, two legs
yeah.
bad. Four
and
legs.
That's really helpful in that story form to show kids the allegory of
yeah,
the result of coming.
My kids didn't read that in high school.
Yeah.
They didn't. It wasn't on their reading list. So,
but to devil's advocate for a minute. I don't even like that phrase.
Well, it'd probably be true in this case.
Well, there's Acts 2. And all who believed were together and had all things in common. They were selling their possessions and belongings and distributing the proceeds to all as any had need. Almost this social care system, in a way. But I guess the difference would be all of that is voluntary right there.
It's a voluntary community.
All of it's voluntary.
It's also a Christian community
yeah.
built on Christian principles.
And the
misconception could be that the ownership no longer exists. And I don't think that's really what it's saying, because I think it becomes clear later that ownership still exists within the community. It's just that they were willing to, those who owned were willing to share what they owned.
Well, even in Martin's service, it was talked about how he would so often share his tools, share what he had.
Yeah.
He didn't give up ownership of those tools. I'm sure he expected it back. But he was, hey, this is available to you. And that could be kind of what's happening.
Yeah, because,
well,
I mean,
I think Ananias and Sapphira
gets yes.
to the idea that it's yours.
Yeah.
You don't owe it to me.
Yeah.
It's a voluntarily given.
Yeah. The fact that, yeah, they got punished because
they lied.
They acted, yeah, right.
It wasn't that they didn't give enough.
They made the promise.
They lied and tried to make it look like they gave more than they did.
Yeah.
But it was still theirs to give.
Right.
And that's why, yeah, that's why I would argue that, well, at first blush, that sounds like a sort of a everybody owns everything. I don't think that's really what was going on there. And again, even if it had been going on, it's a very different context than a government cram down where you have a despotic, unbelieving, Marxist, atheistic leader using his power to keep everybody under control, which is what communism really is.
That is something I wanted to bring up. I didn't know where we were time-wise, because I have known Christians who have used that passage to support the idea that communism or socialism is a good structure. I don't agree with them. And I'm thinking specifically of a guy I knew who was from South America, which there's a lot of the communist
oh, there is,
down
yeah.
there, and they think Che Guevara is this great dude and all that.
Yeah, yeah.
But even as we look at the expansion of the church by Paul's time, the only instruction we have about giving in the New Testament, you know, God loves a cheerful giver, decide in your heart, set a mountain aside that you've decided to give. It shows ownership remains with the individual.
Yeah.
And the giving is voluntary. Also, it shows it's not communistic in nature, because they're giving voluntary gifts to support a church that is not tied to them locally. It's for Jerusalem, which is
yeah.
at that time not even someplace they'd probably ever go in their lifetime. There's just too much to indicate as a giant structure, it doesn't work. It works as small, voluntary, you know, so the idea of setting up communes, which now people are like, whoa, that's a bad word. I get it, and I see the value more like co-op. Not commune.
Yeah.
Maybe co-op is a better word.
Yeah.
And I think that there's value in that, working with your neighbors, you know, seeing what you can do to help each other those kinds of things are good, but when you make it mandatory or controlled by a entity that makes decisions for everyone under it, that's when you run into problems, because humans are by nature corrupt.
Yeah.
So you're never going to have a good, yeah, somebody's corrupt.
Obama said to business owners, you didn't build that. Clinton says to parents, it takes a village to raise a child.
Yeah.
I kind of get what they're saying, but then there's so much baggage to what they're saying that those are dangerous words.
Yeah, especially when you know where that's a means to an end for those guys. I mean, that's their way of pushing us toward communism, which they love the idea of communism.
It all goes back to government control.
Yeah,
government control. Well, I mean, you can see even with where we are in our country, which is not fully communist, look at Obamacare. I will provide coverage for everyone, which we know is not true.
Nope.
But the people in government said, well, we're not going to be under Obamacare. We're
going
to have our own health care that's separate. Mm-hmm. It's better.
Yeah.
It is.
But, and it's like, that's communism in a nutshell, right?
Yeah,
there.
Exactly.
We have this for you and this for us.
Well, yeah. And we just heard that Congress has some exemptions to the mandate that they just put out to business owners.
Oh, they always do that.
I feel like, you know, these people that are our representatives shouldn't be paid $171,000 a year.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I like the idea of the original, you know, when our government first started, it was considered your civic duty. You go serve your term and then you go back to your life. It's not go become a fat cow suckling on America's tax dollars,
right,
and having this lifetime insurance and lifetime retirement and that. And they, and I'm ignorant of how our checks and balances, I don't know about all of them, but obviously at some point our representatives exempted themselves and set themselves aside and gave themselves all of that. And we're all just like, oh, go serve for us, but they don't.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
I think a true representative should have met those people coming into the Congress building on January 6th instead of running and hiding.
Yeah. Yeah, one could wish a lot of ways that had gotten replayed differently.
It's government control.
Yeah.
And yes, politics should be discussed in church.
Oh, yeah. Good. I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know what y'all think, but I mean, not that we want, you know, every sermon to be a political speech. It's not that. But if it's a part of life, it ought to be addressed. If it's a part of your worldview, everything ought to be addressed. You know, whether it's creation, whether it's this, whether it's that, you know, whether it's politics, whether it's family, whatever it is, I would just put that in the bucket of worldview. You know, and certainly we want Christians doing things in the political realm that are God-honoring. I think there are bad decisions that can be made in the political realm. We want Christians to be informed about that. So, yeah, I would think so. All right, well, as always, we have way more to talk about than we can talk, but that's by design to some degree. The point of what we do here is not to exhaust subjects, but is to stimulate thinking and give you something to go away and meditate on. And I think we could spend the next, you know, 2 years on any one of these topics and probably never exhaust it. I know that. But I think if we can at least stimulate people to start thinking in various areas, it just, you know, hopefully will be helpful to you. Father, thank you for the time that we've had this morning, for the good discussion and the good interaction, and help us to make good use of the time that we have and the freedoms that we have while we have them. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.